Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Thursday, May 23rd, 2024. A South Sudanese analyst says the country's economy can be resurrected if the government uses the right tools.
The inflation we have within the country is self-imposed in the sense that our currency does not trade within the regional market, including the East African community.
And opposition hold-up groups in Nairobi meeting for peace talks discuss crucial issues.
Presentations focus on, for example, the type of governance that we may require in the country. And there was an in-depth discussion, for example, on the issue of federalism as a system of governance.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some residents of the South Sudan's capital, Juba, say they are struggling to survive the effects of harsh economic meltdown. The country's vice president for economic cluster, James Wani Iga, told a gathering in Juba this week that the government is not sleeping, adding that the people of South Sudan will soon see changes. But Abraham Nyon, a lecturer at the University of Juba, says the government has done very little to address the economic crisis in South Sudan.
We had a lot of issues that are being tried by the government, but also not done in the way it is supposed to be done. Because, you know, for an economy to respond, it needs a long-term plan. Like what you have just said now, the issue of injecting the hard currency into the market, it is something that it has a response. But always, as you know, it is a short-term thing, which by the end of the day, when the hard currency is over, which means chances are very high for even the dollar to be able to double in the black market, which is taking back. In fact, people had moved ahead in terms of inflation by let's two steps, and then people moved backward one step. And by the time the issue of hard currency, which is supplied into the market, is over, it is double the digit, either three or five steps ahead. That is where there is a problem.
What is in the toolbox that the government could utilize to bring an end to this vicious circle of the dollar going up, the dollar coming down, and then the prices are just...
And a country that does not prioritize production will never be able to stabilize its economy, no matter how hard that country tries to do so. Because the labor consumption within the country could only be stable if the production is the one that supports the level of consumption. So now, if we need to have a quick fix, number one is that our currency is self-regulatory. What does that mean? It means the inflation we have within the country is self-imposed in the sense that our currency does not trade within the regional market, including the East African community. And to be able to adjust that thing, you have to be able to change the currency and make the new adjustment based on the new news that is put in the market. That could be a step number one. Step number two is to strengthen the new currency. The government is supposed to come up with a large-scale campaign on the production, especially subsistence production, that every household should be able to produce food for them to eat, to reduce the level of people going to the market and import maize and import a lot of flour, either from Kenya or from Uganda or from abroad, which means the government should be able to prioritize agriculture.
Looking at the projects that are there in the country, I know there's a huge infrastructure projects that the government is pumping a lot of money into. I'm talking about road connectivity. There was the Juba Bor Road constructed, and there's an ongoing construction from Juba to Bahr el Ghazal. But some areas where you could produce food from, the roads are ignored. Could that be part of the problem?
Since the independence of this country, The government has never been prioritizing in road infrastructure. The prioritization of road infrastructure is something that began 5 years ago in 2018. And at this critical juncture, since all the oil money has been going to the road, assume that it is still flowing. The choice that the government has is the choice of building the road that will have nobody to use it, and a choice that will make them to introduce austerity measures of stopping the road construction and use that money to be invested into the life of the people that will be able to make them to live. Because the level the economy has reached, looking at the soldiers, looking at the civil servant, having gone for 6 or 7 months without salary, and even if that salary comes, it has got no value.
If you look at the prices in the market, it's something that really should worry everybody, because the only people who are able or who have the buying power in South Sudan right now are people working for NGOs. And they're just a small group of people, but the rest have no luxury of even buying a bread. You interact with a lot of people in South Sudan, especially at your place of work. There are a lot of people who are there who will tell you stories. What are people telling you about their coping mechanism? And if I can also throw it to you, how do you survive without being paid for 7 months?
People of South Sudan have gone back to the liberation time. People of South Sudan believe that currently that the government has got no hand in helping them elevate their life, because they believe since everybody was fighting for independent and liberation of this country, and that thing was done free, people are still in freedom spirit, that I should be able to survive, I should be able to suffer for this country, and I don't need anybody to do anything to me. That is a general thinking that everybody has. And that is why you see, if a soldier who has a gun is hungry and the children are hungry, they don't have food, they are sick, they could not go to the hospital, they have no problem with the government, they have problem with themselves, which means they believe the problem that this country has is a problem of everybody. And we can only be able to keep ourselves that way until a miracle happens in the near future.
The conditions that are in South Sudan right now are like not what people were expecting to be in, because this is a country that has resources. And it's unfortunate that the revenues from the resources have not been trickling down to the common men and women on the street. If you look at the situation critically, is there something that the common men and women could do to reverse their conditions?
Well, you know, John, everybody in this country from the time of liberation up to now always believe in making a difference in their life. And this independence was meant to make life better. But as time goes, and because of the way the leaders have been taking things, that is why now everybody has reached into this level. Now, what individual person can do is to make sure that they could continue surviving the way they are surviving. Because so far, I think all 90% of the government employees are not getting any benefit from the government. And as a result of this, this is where each and everyone should only go back to their place and believe in what they can do, whether you go back to your village, you go come to the town, go to the African town and begin doing some farming for yourself. And which means this thing has also to go with individual mental conscience, in the sense that if the civic awareness of the people of South Sudan is empowered, then something will be able to tell them the condition under which we are in is caused by a certain situation, by a certain group of the people.
That's Abraham Nyon, a lecturer at the University of Juba. He spoke with me from Juba earlier today. South Sudanese opposition holdout groups meeting in Nairobi say the negotiations are progressing well. Raja Mohandis, a civil society activist who is a member of the Exiled People's Coalition for Civic Action, says the opposition groups have presented proposals on various important issues blocking the road to peace in South Sudan.
The talks are moving on, and the delegates have been discussing the issues of governance, justice, and economy, and also security. So what happened was that the mediators requested that the delegates should provide their proposals or positions on the issues of governance, security, economy, and also governance. And so these issues were presented, and they compiled them. And then from the different delegations, the delegation of government and the combined delegation of the opposition and also the other stakeholders, and then put them into one document. And this was then presented and discussed. And then they were also returned to the Secretariat of the Mediation to do a few corrections, and the parties and the other stakeholders have been discussing those issues. So that's what is happening right now.
Could you talk to us about some of the key messages or some of the key proposals on governance? Let's look at governance. What are you guys putting on the table?
Well, with the regard to the proposal on governance, of course, there were submissions from different groups. From the government side, they made presentations on what is available, the framework that is there in the agreement and what is being done. And from the side of the other parties, they have also made presentations, and together with the stakeholders, the civil society, and these presentations focus on, for example, the type of governance that we may require in the country. And there was an in-depth discussion, for example, on the issue of federalism as a system of governance. And some of the actors went into details to provide what they think would be a reasonable form of a system of governance. Others made presentations on the issue of the number of states and how they think it should look like. And also, most importantly, with the issue of governance, the issue of the failure of implementation of peace agreements. This has also been presented and discussed, that it's something that should be addressed if the situation in South Sudan should be helped to change, especially with in terms of implementing commitments that are reached, and to learn from the experiences that we've had in the past.
And look, talking about the economy, this is a topic that is very it's in the mouth of every South Sudanese, whether you're in Juba, whether you're in the village. Life is tough. What economic solutions have you guys put on the table that could help South Sudan get out of this serious crisis, economic crisis, I mean?
Well, from our perspective as the PCCA, first of all, we believe that the economic crisis and the security crisis and the issues of justice are a result of governance, problems with governance and leadership in the country. And so we think that if we want to address the issues of the economy, then that is where we should focus attention, address the issues of political leadership in the country, and that we must have a governance arrangement that is effectively functional. And with that, we can successfully address the rest of the issues, which are, in our view, symptoms of the issues of governance and leadership. And then in specific terms, we made proposals in terms of the issues of the economy. There have been proposals in terms of how to, first of all, close and seal the loopholes that tend to swallow the national resources, and then putting in place mechanisms that would provide accountability and then organizing the institutions to be more functional in a way so that they are able to deliver on the core aspects of the economy. So ideally, the proposals are in a manner that without fixing the governance issues, the economic situation may not be easily addressed. And fixing the economy would require, first of all, addressing the issues of the institutions, personnel, and also mechanisms of accountability, so that there is a way to control the resources, and then move on to begin to develop infrastructure that should be able to make the economy work.
That's Raja Mohandis, a civil society activist and a member of the Exiled People's Coalition for Civic Action. He spoke with me earlier today from the venue of the peace talks in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. South Sudan's foreign ministry is planning to cut down the number of diplomats posted in the country's 30 embassies across the world. A senior diplomat at the ministry, who is not authorized to speak to the media, told this program that the foreign minister, Ramadan Abdallah Gooch, is working to pay off 35 months of salary arrears of diplomats and support staff dating back to 2019. South Sudan's former ambassador to the United States, Akech Koch, says the plan to cut the number of diplomats around the embassies across the world should have been implemented long time ago.
The Honorable Minister of Foreign Affairs is trying to do his best by claiming that he would want to pay the arrears of the staff that has not been paid for 35 months. How long did it take that those arrears to accumulate? It took a very long time. And how long will it take at the time when the economy is in shackles to repay the arrears and bring back the staff to the country? I think it is a wishful thinking. It is good, but unfortunately, it will not see the day.
The question that is lingering in the minds of people here is, how did the country end up opening 30 embassies and staffing them? I mean, you're a career diplomat. You were the ambassador here in the United States. Can you tell us the number of staff that should be in an ideal embassy, a functioning embassy?
The number of staff that should be in an ideal embassy depends on the importance of the embassy and the functions it is carrying. If it is carrying diplomatic, trade or investment and other relations, then there would be about 7 diplomats and support staff, like in D.C., like in New York, London, all the big capitals. But initially, we were planning to have few embassies and regional representation. This was our plan because we wanted South Sudan to be represented gradually within the diplomatic corps internationally and move from the neighboring countries and Africa to the other parts of the world. That was our plan. But unfortunately, at inception, many of the political leaders wanted as many embassies as possible and to put in most of their relatives, friends, sons and daughters. Ministers would insist that you send my son to such a place. For example, Nairobi. I don't know how many staff are in Nairobi. There were so many on the request of responsible authorities in Parliament and this. There was no plan. It is very unfortunate that assignments are given, he can be very competent. And no doubt, nobody doubts his patriotism. But is he the right person at the right time in the right place? I think there will be questions there.
Let us talk about the right person in the right place. When the country got its independence and the foreign ministry, every minister, every MP, the executive will bring their sons, their daughters and ask that they be posted abroad in those embassies. How has that affected the effectiveness of these embassies? Because the reason why I'm telling you, I know diplomats who are not able even to write a sentence, and yet they are posted abroad to represent the country.
It has negatively affected the effectiveness of the embassies and the image of South Sudan in this mission. Because when a senior official requests his colleague or her colleague, a minister of foreign affairs, to do this, then it is done immediately. But then the quality of service, of delivery of the individual is not put into account. So you have 20 staff in an embassy, which is supposed to have 6 or 5 or 4, and everybody doesn't care to undertake his or her assignment. And this is a problem. And those who come like that come and sit on the necks of the ambassadors. They want to direct everything. The king, because they are related to X and Y, they must do this or that. And so there is no quality, there is no delivery, there is no what. When you go to a meeting, nothing is being done. South Sudan is seen to just be a triggering country. Either the image of South Sudan, no, we think we have much more to give, to deliver to the world.
I once went to an embassy, and I will not want to mention the name here. People were speaking in their mother tongues, and I was surprised that this is an office that represents the country, and everybody in that embassy were speaking in their own mother tongue. What should the Ministry of Foreign Office do to address these issues of nepotism, tribalism, favoritism?
Brother John, I strongly believe that in order for you to change policy of the government, it will be necessary to start from the top. The economy of South Sudan has been declining throughout. We have changed so many ministers almost twice a year. Has it improved the economy? It hasn't. So if we are, and why is that? I personally feel that the problem is not with the ministers. The ministers are good and they could have delivered more. But the directives they get from the other circles is what makes them fail. So we need to categorically change the leadership of South Sudan. Coming to the Foreign Service, in any country, there must be a plan, a strategic plan for anything. And if you are to start the fundamentals of a Foreign Service, you need to study what are the regions where you need cooperation. What kind of cooperation do you need? Is it economic or is it political? Is it cultural? Is it military? Something of the kind. So, and you gear your missions towards the vision and the aim that you want to achieve.
That's Ambassador Akech Koch, South Sudan's former ambassador to the United States. He spoke with me from New York earlier today. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenyan President William Ruto meets President Joe Biden. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A short while ago, U.S. President Joe Biden welcomed Kenya's President William Ruto to the White House in a ceremony filled with pomp, music, and military honor guards. Ruto, the first African leader to be invited for a state visit to the White House since 2008, told the audience gathered in the White House gardens that he appreciated an opportunity to work with Biden on bolstering the country's relations. He stressed that they share core values of democracy, representation, and prosperity. For more on President Ruto's landmark visit, my colleague Yahya Swihib spoke with Anita Paul, VOA's White House correspondent.
Big deal. This is the first African head of state to get a state visit during the Biden administration. And in fact, the first African head of state to grace the White House for a state visit since 2008 when Ghana's president came. So this is a signal, the White House told me earlier this week, that the White House, that Washington really respects Kenya's efforts to step up on the world stage. They're referring, of course, to their decision to send about 1,000 security forces to Haiti, which is the unstable Caribbean nation that is riven by gang violence. violence. So this visit is meant to communicate from the White House's side that they value Kenya as an ally. And perhaps there's no greater indication of that than what President Biden announced this morning at the arrival ceremony, which is that he intends to make Kenya a major non-NATO ally. Only about 19, 20 countries have this qualification, and they enjoy special access to weapons sales, military training, a lot of the benefits that NATO members enjoy, but without, of course, the mutual security agreement that ties NATO together. So this is a big deal, and it's combined with big announcements. So it's not just pomp, but it's also substance.
What are the elements of this visit?
Sure. So I think you probably want me to start with the flashiest part, which is the dinner. There are going to be some 500 guests at the dinner tonight, a big state dinner with a gospel choir and country singers. And of course, there will be red meat on the menu. As many Kenyans know, this is a fixture at any Kenyan feast. So we're going to have that. But ahead of that, and right now as we speak, President Biden and President Ruto's delegations are meeting and talking about a raft of agreements, everything from technology to security assistance to climate management, education, health, and more. The only thing that they're kind of not talking about is the thing that Kenya and other African countries generally go to China for, which is roads, bridges, hard infrastructure. Those are usually covered by the Belt and Road Initiative, which is the $1 trillion initiative that spans the globe, and Africa's the biggest beneficiary. So this is a visit that where they're making lots of agreements about development and recognizing Kenya as a major partner of the U.S.
That's Anita Powell, VOA White House correspondent, who attended the welcoming ceremony for President William Ruto. She spoke to my colleague Yehes Wihu from the White House. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, May 23rd, 2024. We now leave you with the song Zawangu by Afrigo. You've been listening to Afrigo and the song Zawango. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Nelson Lopez, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.